Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Afghanistan's Karzai welcomes U.S. troop timeline and voting light in extra day of Egypt's presidential election. I'm Bob Doty reporting from Washington. Afghan President Hamid Karzai is welcoming U.S. President Barack Obama's decision to pull all American troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2016. Mr. Karzai issued a statement Wednesday saying ending the U.S. military presence in his country has been a long-time goal of the Afghan government and people, who are thankful for the international community's contribution and support. Tuesday, President Obama outlined details of his plan for reducing American forces in Afghanistan after the end of this year. Appearing Wednesday on U.S. television, Secretary of State John Kerry hit out at critics of Mr. Obama's decision, saying the timeline is not an abandonment of Afghanistan, but an empowerment of the country.
Everything that has been accomplished in Afghanistan in the last 5 years has been accomplished with a deadline. When President Obama came in, there was no policy. The president increased the troops, put a policy in place, and set a deadline for the Afghans to be able to take over security. Guess what? They met the deadline.
President Obama said Afghans will assume more responsibility for their own security, with Americans acting as advisors over the next 2 years. He called for a new security agreement with the next Afghan president.
Yet this is how wars end in the 21st century. Not through signing ceremonies, but through decisive blows against our adversaries, transitions to elected governments, security forces who are trained to take the lead, and ultimately full responsibility.
Polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day Wednesday as the government tries to boost voter turnout in the contest widely expected to bring former Army Chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to power. An unexpectedly low number of voters in the first 2 days prompted the country's election commission to extend voting, but turnout early Wednesday was still light. A high turnout is seen as key to legitimizing Sisi's long-assumed win in a process that began when he led the army's ouster of former President Mohamed Morsi last July. Somalia's army chief has escaped an apparent bomb attack in the capital, Mogadishu. Security officials say the roadside bomb exploded Wednesday as an armored convoy carrying General Dahir Adan Elmi was passing by. The army commander told VOA that he is safe and none of his bodyguards were wounded in the attack, which took place in the Hodan district as the convoy traveled to the defense ministry. Police conducted a security operation after the blast and arrested nearly 30 people. There was no immediate claim of responsibility. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says fugitive intelligence leaker Edward Snowden should man up and return to the United States to face espionage charges. The top U.S. diplomat disparaged the former national security contractor Wednesday, describing the 30-year-old Snowden as a man who has betrayed his country. The fact is, he has damaged his country very significantly. Snowden is living in asylum in Russia a year after leaking a vast cache of National Security Agency documents to journalists that describe clandestine U.S. spy operations around the world. Chinese authorities used a public rally in the violence-hit region of Xinjiang to sentence 55 people on charges including terrorism. The official Xinhua News Agency says 7,000 locals and officials witnessed the mass sentencing Tuesday at a stadium in northern Xinjiang's Yili Prefecture. At least three people were sentenced to death. Others were jailed for murder, separatism, and organizing or participating in terror groups. The leader of Russia's Chechnya region has denied sending men to fight on the side of pro-Russian separatists at eastern Ukraine. Ramzan Kadyrov issued a statement on Instagram Tuesday officially denying claims that, as he put it, Chechen units from Russia had invaded eastern Ukraine. No Chechen servicemen, especially Chechen military convoys, are taking part in the conflict, Kadyrov wrote. And renowned American poet, author, and rights activist Maya Angelou has died at the age of 86. The author of the celebrated 1970 autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, died in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. 1993, former President Bill Clinton asked Angelou to write a poem for his inauguration. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
Many of the reasons to lapse into a crisis are there right now, especially in the center part of southern Somalia. And the second part of the problem is that we have a major reduction in funding for all sectors, health, nutrition, water and sanitation, education, child protection, and many more.
That's UNICEF's Peter Haley warning that a funding shortage threatens the health of hundreds of thousands of children in Somalia. Also in the news, polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day today as the government tries to boost voter turnout. In Malawi, the vote count of the presidential election may not be announced until all court challenges surrounding the election have been resolved. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Liberia in our feature segment. Today, the United States lost a preeminent poet and writer, Maya Angelou. We will remember her life. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day today as the government tries to boost voter turnout in the contest widely expected to bring former army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to power. An unexpectedly low number of voters in the first 2 days prompted the country's election commission to extend voting, but turnout early today was still light. A high turnout is seen as key to legitimizing Sisi's long-assumed win in a process that began when he led the army's ouster of former President Mohamed Morsi last July. Mr. Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood has urged Egyptians to boycott the vote and said in a statement yesterday that Sisi and his allies will not be able to legitimize their actions with more fraud and tricks. Leftist politician Hamdin Sabahi is the only other candidate on the ballot. Official results are expected next week. In Malawi, the vote count of the presidential election may not be announced until all court challenges surrounding the election have been resolved. AFP quotes an anonymous official as saying, the unofficial count shows that Peter Mutharika of the Democratic Progress Party is in the lead with 36% of the vote. Lazarus Chakwera of the Malawi Congress Party is in second place with 28%. And incumbent Joyce Banda is in third place with 20% of the vote count. No comment on the claim from the Electoral Commission. However, commission lawyer reportedly are studying the various lawsuits filed over the election. Ms. Banda and opposition parties have gone to court charging there were irregularities in the election. Somalia's army chief has escaped an apparent bomb attack in the capital, Mogadishu. Security officials say the roadside bomb exploded today as an armored convoy carrying General Dahir Adan Elmi was passing by. The army commander told VOA that he is safe and that none of his bodyguards were wounded in the attack, which took place in the Hodan district as the convoy traveled to the defense ministry. Police conducted a security operation after the blast and arrested nearly 30 people. There was no immediate claim of who was responsible. The UN's Children's Fund, UNICEF, warns that without immediate action from donors, health services for 3 million Somali women and children could end soon. The agency says it's received only about $15 million of its $140 million appeal made earlier this year. Peter Haley is chief of nutrition for UNICEF Somalia. He spoke to VOA's Jody Capua about the current condition of children in the country and why they may be at risk.
We're in much better situation than we were during and just after the famine. We've had several good seasons of rainfall and harvests and grazing for the animals in general across the country. But in each of those seasons, there's been places in the country that had rain failures or had been affected by other issues such as conflict or access problems. And prices have been rising in many places in the markets. Although on the face of it, we could say that the situation has improved considerably in Somalia, you still have a population who are deeply vulnerable.
Many organizations are saying that Somalia is at risk of relapsing into a major humanitarian crisis once again. Would you agree?
There's two issues. One, many of the reasons to lapse into a crisis are there right now, especially in the center part of southern Somalia. And the second part of the problem is that we have a major reduction in funding for all sectors, health, nutrition, water and sanitation, education, child protection, and many more. So when we say risk, we mean that when we look out there at what could cause a major humanitarian crisis, many of the factors are there. And then what can we do to mitigate those risk factors? We can do much less than we usually do because we have much less funding.
Now, UNICEF, of course, is calling for full funding for its health operations. Can you give me an idea of exactly what type of services you provide and what services might end if you don't get your emergency funding?
The health program works on supporting the health facilities in providing all basic health services to the population, particularly in the central and southern part of Somalia. Those services range from the free vaccinations for simple diseases like measles, polio, and other diseases that are prevented by vaccination, through to treatment of diarrhea, treatment of pneumonia, and treatment of malaria and other diseases such as those, where children are extremely high risk of dying without that treatment. UNICEF supports NGOs and government across the whole of Somalia. With the current reduction in funding, very soon we're going to have to start closing some of the services in some of the most vulnerable places of Somalia. We expect that that would probably affect around 620,000 children under five just on the immunizations alone. And then 280,000 pregnant women would no longer have services for antenatal checkups. And around 720,000 women of childbearing age would not be able to get their vaccinations or any of the type of support that they would need.
Some have criticized UN agencies for making what they call dire predictions about what might happen if they don't get the funding, and that the agencies do that to try to spur donors on. How would you respond to that criticism?
You know, in Somalia, we've been through the famine, and one of the main criticisms for what happened just before the famine is that we waited too long to start talking about the issues we were facing. So the humanitarian community, including the donors, are all very sensitive to whether we should start talking earlier or whether we should wait until we have some surer signs of a crisis happening. So we always have a dilemma. Shall we start crying now, or shall we wait until we've got even more malnourished children or even more evidence that we're heading into a problem? And I think that overall, the NGOs, the UN agencies have all taken the decision to start speaking a bit earlier and start highlighting where our particular problems are.
How much money does UNICEF need, and when do you need it?
Our top priority is the health program, and it's around 12.6 million is needed immediately. Basically, we will need to start closing programs in the coming days and weeks and months as the funding runs out. The other programs, at the moment, we're funded around 10%. We requested at the beginning of the year 140 million, and so far we have 10% of that, about $15 million available. So you can see that it's very, very much below what we expected to be able to do this year.
Besides the funding issue, are there any other major concerns that you have regarding Somalia?
We have delayed rains, which are affecting parts of Somalia. And in those areas, the population are very vulnerable and will be descending into a very high crisis situation. The second area where we really are worried right at this moment are the several towns which have recently come under the control of AMISOM and the government, but they're surrounded by the Shabab. and we're not able to get access by road to those towns, and the people themselves are not able to replenish their stocks through the markets, as no supplies are getting in whatsoever. So our priority is to try and establish an air bridge to support those populations. As you can imagine, if this goes on for many days or weeks more, then the markets will be empty, the people's food stocks will have gone, and the medical supplies will have finished. And we can be looking at some pretty drastic situations in those towns.
Peter Haley is Chief of Nutrition for UNICEF Somalia. He spoke to VOA's Jody Kebua. The UN Security Council voted unanimously yesterday to refocus the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan to concentrate primarily on protecting civilians from intercommunal violence. At the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir says the Council also has warned those obstructing peace and reconciliation that they could face international sanctions.
UNMISS, as the mission is known, was created in 2011 to help the world's newest country achieve peace and support longer-term development. But with the outbreak of violence last December, the mission has had to turn all of its attention to protecting civilians. Now the mission officially will move away from peace-building activities to protecting civilians, aiding the delivery of humanitarian assistance, monitoring human rights, and preventing renewed violence. UN Peacekeeping Chief Hervé Letsous told VOA the new mandate formalizes activities that the peacekeepers have been trying to carry out since the crisis erupted.
We've been doing that since early this year, and so it's confirmation that these are the priorities, pending such time as there will be a political settlement. And then, of course, we'll have to think on the basis of that settlement what will be the longer-term tasks that will need to be redefined.
In December, the UN Security Council increased UNMISS troop strength from about 7,000 to more than 12,000. Not all have arrived yet. The surge will include about 2,500 peacekeepers who will protect ceasefire monitors in South Sudan. The resolution adopted Tuesday expresses support for ceasefire agreements signed in January and earlier this month, and calls for their immediate and full implementation. The Security Council also vowed to consider all appropriate measures against parties who undermine peace and security, a reference to the possible imposition of sanctions. South Sudan's Ambassador Francis Madang Dang told the Council his government is disappointed that UN assistance for strengthening government capacities is no longer a part of the mandate, and hopes it will be included when the mandate comes up for an extension in November.
The objective of capacity building is to help create a state that is capable, responsible, and responsive, not a state that is oppressive. Failure to help build a functioning state could lead to serious problems which the United Nations and the international community might be later called upon to help address.
The situation in South Sudan remains tense, with sporadic violations to the ceasefire between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and his former Vice President Riek Machar. The United Nations says the violence has displaced more than 1.3 million people. Many have fled to neighboring countries, and about 80,000 are sheltering at UN bases across South Sudan that are not equipped to handle such large numbers of people. Now that the rainy season has begun, the UN's Department of Humanitarian Affairs says it has recorded nearly 600 cases of the waterborne disease cholera in the capital, Juba. 22 people have died. A vaccination program is underway. At a donors' conference in Oslo, Norway last week, donors pledged more than $600 million out of the nearly $2 billion needed to fund the humanitarian response through the end of this year. The UN warns that 4 million people face severe food insecurity because of the fighting and their inability to plant for the next harvest. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A former Nigerian defense minister says time is running out for the government to tackle growing violence in the northeastern part of the country, including the kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls and recent attacks on villages. Rabuyi Kwankoso served in the administration of former President Olusegun Obasanjo. He's currently Kano Kano state governor and is a leading figure in the opposition All Progressive Congress Party. He left the ruling People's Democratic Party last year and is considered a potential presidential candidate. Kwan Kwoso told AFP that President Goodluck Jonathan failed to heed advice to pay more attention to the problems of poverty, unemployment, and illiteracy. He says Nigeria is now reaping the consequences of that failure. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day today as the government tries to boost the voter turnout. In Malawi, the vote count of the presidential election may not be announced until all court challenges surrounding the election have been resolved. And Somalia's army chief has escaped an apparent bomb attack in the capital Mogadishu. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. In a majority of African countries, at least 30% of girls are married before age 18, often against their will. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa. The rate has led the African Union to launch a two-year campaign to end child marriage in Africa.
14 million girls below the age of 18 are forced into marriage each year by their parents in developing countries. Most of these countries are in Africa. Zanabu is a 16-year-old girl from Niger. She says that she was taken out of school by her parents to get married, but her husband would beat her if she didn't want him to touch her. She ran away to her parents, but they would also beat her and return her to the husband. She says she eventually ran away to an aunt and wants to go back to school. Girls married at a young age often have mental anguish, suffer health problems due to early pregnancies, and are less likely to get an education. Most of them come from poorly educated families and rural areas where girls cannot oppose the cultural norms of the family and community. The African Union campaign to end child marriage is focused on policy action and raising continental awareness. The director of the AU Social Affairs Commission, Olawe Megun, says member states of the AU should follow and implement legal frameworks that protect children.
The Charter on the Rights of the Child, for example, has clear provisions on harmful practices against the child. And it's clear in the provisions of the Charter, culture or religious or whatever should not be an excuse, and the states must take measures to eliminate them. People use all sorts of excuses to perpetuate what they're doing, but it's not an excuse as far as the Commission is concerned.
Among African countries, child marriage rates are highest in Niger and Chad, with rates above 70%. In Zambia, the rate is 42%. 10 government ministries, including health, education, and legal affairs, are working together to bring that rate down. Zambian Minister of Chiefs and Traditional Affairs, Nkandu Luyo, says traditional chiefs are also trying to change the cultural norm about child marriage in the country.
The reason we felt that the chiefs should be the ones is because it hinges on customary law, and there's also a belief that it is to do with our cultures. When any parent is reported to the chief, first of all, they appear before the chief, because there's the traditional court. So they appear before the traditional court and they are charged according to the decision by the traditional court. But they also make sure they go and take that child out of marriage and put her back into school.
The End Child Marriage campaign of the AU is done in cooperation with African governments, UNICEF, and civil society organizations. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Niger and the French state-owned uranium firm Areva signed a new mining deal on Monday after more than 2 years of negotiations. Activists say they are cautiously optimistic about the terms of the New Deal, in which Arriva has promised to increase royalties to the country and invest in local infrastructure. Jennifer Lazuta has more from our West Africa Bureau.
The government of Niger said Monday that it has renegotiated its expired mining contract with the French uranium company Arriva. The exact terms of the new contract have not yet been made public. But according to a joint statement by Arriva and Niger's government, Arriva has agreed to operate under the framework of the country's 2006 mining code, which requires paying an increased share of profits to the government and has fewer tax exemptions. Niger is one of the world's largest producers of uranium and yet remains one of the poorest countries in the world. Activists say it's about time Niger got a fair share of the mining profits. Ali Idrissa is the national coordinator for Publish What You Pay Niger, a network of organizations that campaign for transparency and accountability in the mining sector. He said the signing of the contract is a promising step forward, but not enough. He says for more than 5 months, Arriva has continued to refuse to apply the Nigerian mining law. Now they have arrived at a deal, but we don't yet know what exactly is in the contract. He says the government needs to respect the constitution and publish the new terms, and then apply the law to Arriva so that Arriva's uranium extraction activities actually benefit our citizens. Arriva's previous mining contract, which was signed in 2001 and based on Niger's 1993 mining code, expired last year. Under the old terms, the company was exempt from paying export duties on uranium, as well as from all customs duties and value-added taxes on mining materials and equipment. Under the new contract, Niger could see an increase in the rate of mining royalties from 5.5% up to 12%. Publish What You Pay says that a decrease in VAT exemptions could increase tax revenues by between $13.6 million and $20.5 million per year. Arriva says it also plans to invest an estimated $160 million in local infrastructure projects. However, the company, which has previously stated that the terms of the 2006 mining code are not profitable, says it will delay the start of production at its newest mine until the new terms become profitable. The delay at the mine, which is expected to double Niger's current uranium output, could mean a significant loss of revenue for the government. Alice Powell, the communications coordinator for Publish What You Pay, said only time will tell how the new deal benefits Niger's people.
I think the key thing is, however, is when the contract itself is published and we can see all the details, we can see the extent of this, then make sure and see what exemptions and concessions have been granted to see how much the government is really getting and the extent to which the mining code is being applied in full.
Powell said that Niger's constitution requires that the contract be made publicly available. Publish What You Pay is calling for it to be published immediately. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga.
Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Polls in Egypt's presidential election are open for an extra day today as the government tries to boost voter turnout. In Malawi, the vote count of the presidential election may not be announced until all court challenges surrounding the election have been resolved. And Somalia's army chief has escaped an apparent bomb attack in the capital, Mogadishu. Coming up, music from Liberia, and in our feature segment, today, the United States has lost one of its preeminent writers and poets, Maya Angelou. We will remember her life. I'm Yehiye Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. Hello, Sonny.
Hello, Yehias.
Sonny, I understand a big tennis upset tops your sports report.
Yehias, my opening serve is a big French Open tennis upset. Defending women's champion Serena Williams was ousted in the second round Wednesday, 6-2 and 6-2, by Garbina Muguruza, a 20-year-old Spanish player who was born in Venezuela. Serena, the world's number one ranked female player, looked flat and never found her rhythm against Muguruza, ranked 35th in the world. Serena made 29 unforced errors during the match, and she also struggled with her usually dominant serve. The 32-year-old Williams was broken five times. Speaking after the match, Serena said, and I quote, "I don't think anything worked for me. It was one of those days. I hate to be off during a Grand Slam tournament." Meanwhile, Serena's older sister, Venus, who turns 34 next month, also had a bad day on Wednesday. And like Serena, Venus lost to a much younger opponent. Venus lost in three sets to 19-year-old Anna Schmidlova of Slovakia. The final score from Roland Garros, 2-6, 6-3, and 6-4. Schmidlova will now play Muguruza in the third round of the prestigious clay court competition.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
Thunder up, VOA basketball fans. The Oklahoma City Thunder storm past the visiting San Antonio Spurs 105-92 to even the NBA's Western Conference Finals at two games each. Star guard Russell Westbrook led the way for the Thunder in Game 4, tallying 40 points and 10 assists. Kevin Durant, the NBA's leading scorer and league most valuable player, added 31 points for Oklahoma City. Game 5 in the best-of-seven series will be Thursday night in San Antonio, Texas. The Thunder has turned around the series since Congolese power forward Serge Ibaka returned from a calf injury that was expected to sideline him for the rest of the NBA playoffs. Ibaka had 9 points and 8 rebounds in Game 4. Meanwhile, the two-time defending champion Miami Heat can advance once again to the NBA Finals later Wednesday night when they visit the Indiana Pacers. Miami leads the Eastern Conference Finals 3-1, and the Heat will try to close the series in Indianapolis. Elsewhere in basketball, a very tall high school player from Senegal is attracting attention for his size and rapid development in the sport. Elhadji Tako Fall is 7'5" tall, or 2.26 meters tall, and he plays for Liberty Christian Prep in Central Florida. 18-year-old Tako started playing basketball shortly before he came to the United States in 2012. VOA's Daniel Brown reached Taco by telephone in Florida, and he asked the Senegalese teenager how he started playing basketball.
Just came to me. I was back in Senegal, and I met a guy whose name is Ibrahima, and that's him who put me into basketball.
So he's the one that taught you just about everything you know so far?
No, he had like a training academy. He talked to me about playing basketball and that he could help me come to the United States where I would have more opportunity to come and train and play. So he came and talked to my parents. That's how I started. It was like a year and a half ago.
Are you getting used to playing basketball? Or do you like it so far?
Yes, it was hard at the beginning because I was not used to it at all. So I struggled a little bit. But now, I mean, I have got some good coaches around me who's been teaching me a lot of stuff. I've been getting a lot better these couple weeks, too.
How does it feel be the tallest player on the court?
I mean, it feels good. But at the same time, it kind of put a lot of pressure on me at the beginning because I'm the one almost everybody's looking. At the beginning, I couldn't handle it, but now it's kind of natural to me.
If you went up against another 7-footer, how do you think you would go against him?
I think I would do well because usually when I play against a 7-footer, it's like a 7-footer playing against a 6'5". I've been working on my skills these last days, too. I think I would do well.
Talking about your skills, what is your primary thing? Like if it's like boxing out or rebounding or posting up or just playing solid defense, what is like one of your main goals you want to improve on?
Aggressiveness. I think that's all I need, just being aggressive. All the other stuff are just basic stuff.
Do you think you can have like a takeover factor later in the years?
I think it's coming along pretty well now.
What are some of like your accomplishments that you want to achieve on the court within your 4 years of high school?
I mean, I only have one more year of high school left. And I started my sophomore year, so it depends on how hard I work on the court, and I need to work hard too and play a lot.
During a game, is there a person that you like to play like?
I used to think of Yao Ming.
Yao Ming?
Yes.
Do you have a hook shot like Yao Ming?
Sometimes.
I know you play AAU. What are some of your career high numbers in high school so far and AAU?
In high school, I have scored, I think, 26 in one half. I didn't play the second half because my coach didn't want me to play the second half.
Just on like your upcoming season, I guess in the fall and during this coming summer, what is like your biggest concern when you're playing in tournaments since it'll be your last year?
I'm just looking forward to run the court and do the basic stuff. Run the court, rebound, block shots. The scoring will come along, I'm pretty sure, pretty soon. Just to focus on doing what I have to do.
That's Elhaji Taco Fall, a 7'5" tall high school basketball player from Dakar, Senegal. And Taco was talking by telephone from Florida with VOA's Daniel Brown. Taco says he hopes to play basketball at the collegiate level, and I'm betting he gets more than a few scholarship offers. In African club football, an all-Congolese match was one of the featured fixtures in recent CAF Champions League competition. Our African football guru, David Legg, breaks down the action for us, beginning with Group A.
Group A, we've got TP Mazembe of DR Congo 1, Vita Club of DR Congo 0. That's a Congolese derby. And then Zamalek of Egypt 2, Al Hilal of Sudan 1. And the standings after two rounds, Zamalek, Hilal, Vita, and Mazembe all have got 3 points. They've all won one game and lost one game. And for those who are interested, Zamalek are top because they have scored 3 goals. Hilal have scored 2, Vita have scored 2, and Mazembe have scored 1. So at the moment, Mazembe are bottom, but only on goals scored. All the teams with 3 points, and they all have an identical 0-goal difference. The next match is sunny on June 6-8. You've got Hilal at home to Vita and Mazembe at home to Zamalek. And switching to Group B, Anton Satif of Algeria 1, CS Faxing of Tunisia 1. And then a big shock, Al Ahly of Benghazi of Libya 3, Esperance of Tunisia 2. That match was played in Tunisia because of the civil unrest in Libya. The standing sunny, Sfaxien and Satif with 4 points each, Benghazi with 3, and Esperance bottom without a single point. The third round fixtures on June 6, 7, and 8, Esperance against Sfaxien and Satif against Benghazi. And a reminder to all our listeners, group winners and runners-up qualify for the semifinals.
David, you mentioned that big Benghazi victory. Was that one of your personal highlights?
Oh, yes, Sonny, and it had severe repercussions for the Esperance coach, Dutchman Ruud Krol. He was sacked the following morning, and he's been replaced by a French coach, Sébastien de Saber, who was the technical director at the club. Now, it's all a bit funny in a way, Sonny, although I'm sure Ruud Krol doesn't see it that way. But de Saber was actually appointed the coach of Esperance, and then Krol became available, so de Saber was moved to technical director, which I always find to be a rather puzzling position. And now, of course, with these two defeats, Sonny, at home to Sétif and technically away to Benghazi, but the match was played in a Tunisian city of Sfax, so it was virtually a home game for Esperance. And those two defeats have now cost Ruud Krol his job. The Libyan, Sonny, got off to a great start. Goals from Sodoma, he's a Zimbabwean, and Mbarak within 12 minutes. Esperance pulled one back, but then a Nigerian, Moses Okuma, scored on the stroke of halftime to give Benghazi a 3-1 lead. The second half, the traffic was mainly in the direction of the Benghazi goal, but they held out until 11 minutes from the end when Daragi reduced the rears. And then in a frenetic finish, the Libyans held out for a great victory. Al Ahly, of course, are the side who knocked out the Egyptian Al Ahly, the defending champions, in the qualifying rounds. The other game, Sonny, the top of the table clash between Sétif and Sfaxien. A goal by Bellamira after 12 minutes for the Algerians, and Maloul, the captain of Sfaxien, equalizing in first half stoppage time. After the problems at the last Mazembe Vita game, which sadly cost 15 lives and left dozens of people injured, I'm very pleased to report that there were absolutely no crowd problems in the match in Lubumbashi between Mazembe and Vita. And it was decided with a goal from Samata, the Tanzanian, after 62 minutes. So well done to the supporters of Mazembe and Vita. And in Cairo, an unlikely hero for Zamalek in their 2-1 win over Hilal. It was the defender, Mohamed Abdel Shafti. I've seen the goal, Sonny, on YouTube. What a superb effort. It had a little bit of Messi and it had a little bit of Ronaldo as he juggled the ball from one foot to the other and then unleashed a fierce shot which flew into the net 8 minutes from time. Abdel Shafti was the real star because he also set up the opening goal after 6 minutes for Da Silva. And then El Tayeb equalized for Hilal. So really interesting situation now, Sonny. In one group, all the teams are on the same number of points. And in the other group, only 1 point separates the top three teams. And the one struggling team are the team we all thought would be rampant in the group stage, and that's Esperance of Tunisia.
David, who are the leading scorers now in the CAF Champions League?
Yes, Sonny, it's getting tight at the top. You've still got Junini of Esperance and Ngasa of Young Africans of Tanzania on top with 6 goals each. But then on 5 goals, you've got Bellamira, who scored at the weekend from Sétif. You've got Ijour of Raja Casablanca of Morocco. You've got Mubeli of Vita of Dior Congo. You've got Musona from Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa. And you've got Sodoma, the Zimbabwean from Benghazi of Libya. So the likes of Sodoma now and Bellamiri, I think they've got their eyes, Sonny, on that Golden Boot Award. They're just 1 goal behind the leaders.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Finally, a quick Sunny Side of Sports birthday shout-out for Tony Agbuntayan, one of our loyal VOA listeners in Benin City, Nigeria. Happy birthday, Tony. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhi.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. The United States has lost one of its preeminent writers and poets, Maya Angelou. The 86-year-old scholar was a Reynolds Professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. A statement issued by the university this morning called her a national treasure whose life and teachings inspired millions around the world. Angelou gained fame with her autobiography, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, published in 1969. It told the story of her childhood with her grandmother in Stamps, Arkansas, her experiences with racism, poverty, and about her family and personal strength in the Deep South. Over the decades, Dr. Angelou's reputation grew both nationally and internationally. She read her poem on the Pulse of the Morning at the inauguration of President Bill Clinton in 1993.
Mr. President and Mrs. Clinton, Mr. Vice President and Mrs. Gore, and Americans everywhere, a rock, a river, a tree, hosts to species long since departed, marked the mastodon, the dinosaur, who left dry tokens of their sojourn here on our planet floor. Any broad alarm of their hastening doom is lost in the gloom of dust and ages. But today, the rock cries out to us clearly, forcefully, come, you may stand upon my back and face your distant destiny, but seek no haven in my shadow. I will give you no hiding place down here. You, created only a little lower than the angels, have crouched too long in the bruising darkness, have lain too long face down in ignorance, your mouths spilling words armed for slaughter. The rock cries out to us today, you may stand upon me, but do not hide your face. Across the wall of the world, a river sings a beautiful song. It says, come, rest here by my side. Each of you, a bordered country, delicate and strangely made, proud, yet thrusting perpetually under siege. Your armed struggles for profit have left collars of waste upon my shore, currents of debris upon my breast. Yet today, I call you to my riverside, if you will study war no more. Come, clad in peace, and I will sing the songs the Creator gave to me when I and the tree and the rock were one. You who gave me my first name, you Pawnee, Apache, Seneca, you Cherokee Nation, who rested with me, then forced on bloody feet, left me to the employment of other seekers, desperate for gain, starving for gold. You the Turk, the Arab, the Swede, the German, the Eskimo, the Scot, you the Ashanti, the Yoruba, the Crew, bought, sold, stolen, arriving on a nightmare, praying for a dream. Here, root yourselves beside me. I am that tree planted by the river which will not be moved.
More recently, Maya Angelou wrote a poem in memory of the late South African President Nelson Mandela called His Day Is Done.
His day is done. Is done. The news came on the wings of a wind reluctant to carry its burden. Nelson Mandela's day is done. The news expected and still unwelcome reached us in the United States, and suddenly our world became somber. Our skies were leadened. His day is done. We see you, South African people, standing speechless at the slamming of that final door through which no traveler returns. Our spirits reach out to you, Bantu, Zulu, Xhosa, Boer. We think of you and your son of Africa, your father, your one more wonder of the world. We send our souls to you as you reflect upon your David, armed with a mere stone, facing down the mighty Goliath. No sun outlasts its sunset, but will rise again and bring the dawn. Yes, Mandela's day is done, Yet we, his inheritors, will open the gates wider for reconciliation, and we will respond generously to the cries of blacks and whites, Asian, Hispanics, the poor who live piteously on the floor of our planet. He has offered us understanding. We will not withhold forgiveness, even from those who do not ask. Nelson Mandela's day is done. We confess it in tearful voices, yet we lift our own to say thank you. Thank you, our Gideon. Thank you, our David, our great courageous man. We will not forget you. We will not dishonor you. We will remember and be glad that you lived among us, that you taught us, and that you loved us all.
That was U.S. poet and writer Maya Angelou, dead at age 86. Dr. Angelou said she would never retire because that would mean pulling back from life. But observers say her works guarantee that her voice will never be extinguished. The World Health Organization issued a wake-up call last month when it reported that we have now entered into a post-antibiotic period. That means some common bacterial infections no longer respond as quickly or at all to drugs that used to contain them. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Bacteria are tiny living beings, neither plant nor animal. Some, like the bacteria in yogurt, are good for us, but others are deadly. Like the World Health Organization, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has found that some bacteria no longer respond to antibiotics like they used to. Dr. Laurie Hicks is with the CDC.
And we are seeing greater than 2 million episodes of antibiotic-resistant infections in people each year in the U.S. alone. And 23,000 of these episodes result in death.
If there are messages the CDC wants to get out, one is this.
We want doctors to know, first of all, that antibiotic resistance is a big problem.
Another is this.
We want patients to know that antibiotics don't work for viral infections.
Antibiotic resistance already has changed the way medicine is practiced in hospitals like Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. Doctors there are now more cautious about how they use antibiotics, and they constantly review treatment plans to see if patients are getting the right antibiotics and the right dose.
Hello.
Dr. Trish Pearl is an epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins Medicine.
You all of a sudden understand what it was like to practice medicine maybe 50, 70, 80 years ago when there weren't antibiotics.
Nearby at the University of Maryland Medical Center, doctors have changed the way they care for patients in the intensive care unit. MRSA is an antibiotic-resistant staph infection that spreads easily in a hospital, especially in an intensive care unit, and it can be deadly. Dr. Anthony Harris studied whether having healthcare workers wear gloves and gowns in intensive care units could reduce the number of infections.
Wearing gloves and gowns for all patient contact led to a significant decrease in MRSA acquisition, accounting for about a 40% decrease.
Dr. Pearl says more money needs to be poured into research so that health officials can understand how these organisms are spread. New drugs need to be developed to take the place of those that no longer work, and patients need to be educated.
Resistance commonly develops when people skip medications or, you know, take it one day and not the next, or they don't really think they need it, so they only take half of their course. And that's been particularly problematic with diseases like tuberculosis.
Solutions need to be found fast because the World Health Organization warns that antibiotic resistance is a problem so serious that it threatens the achievements of modern medicine. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has joined with other donor nations to significantly increase humanitarian assistance to the people of South Sudan. The United States is committed to meeting the immediate needs of those affected by the conflict, including more than 1.3 million people who are displaced, as we work to end the conflict and the devastating toll that it has taken. More than 50 nations gathered in Oslo, Norway on May 19th and 20th, and pledged more than $618 million in additional humanitarian aid to help those displaced inside South Sudan, as well as those who have fled to neighboring countries. Of the total, the U.S. is contributing $290.6 million. The new U.S. funds will support a variety of humanitarian aid efforts, including ramping up the distribution of food items and specialty nutrition supplements for children suffering from malnutrition, and to address a looming famine. This new assistance will also address chronic food insecurity by providing seeds, tools, and agricultural training to help South Sudanese farmers restart their livelihoods. On the health front, the new U.S. assistance will help prevent the spread of disease by providing safe drinking water, latrines, and training on safe hygiene practices. Emergency health services will be expanded, both in South Sudan and in neighboring countries that are hosting refugees from the conflict. Construction of camps and nutrition programs will be aided in those nations as well. That said, the new U.S. assistance and that of our international partners can only be effective if the parties to the conflict stop their fighting and remove all obstacles to the delivery of this life-saving effort. It is crucial that both sides implement the May 9th agreement to end the violence and allow immediate, full, and unconditional access to the United Nations and humanitarian organizations to reach those in need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Africa. I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports.
My name is Edward Ameyibo. I listen to Daybreak Africa to be abreast with developments on the continent. I encourage you to do the same.
You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.